Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government is here with news from Monticello, including a discussion about possibly conferring investigatory powers on the Human Rights Office. The Afghan refugee arrested by ICE in October and whose case became a rallying point in the Hudson Valley has been released from ICE custody. We'll have the details. Earth Day celebrations continue through the weekend, and one local festival is bringing families together with a focus on sustainability. We'll speak with the head of the Pocono Environmental Education Center. And for National Poetry Month, we hear from Kevin Scott Graham, Sullivan County Poet Laureate. It's all coming up right after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth is urging European countries to join the U.S. effort to open the Strait of Hormuz. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports it could take 6 months to clear the key waterway.
At a news conference, Hegseth repeated President Trump's threat to destroy any Iranian small boats laying mines in the narrow strait, through which about 20% of the world's oil passes.
We would welcome a serious European effort to do something about this strait and this passage, considering it's their energy capabilities that are most at stake.
But since oil is globally traded, the blockade is driving up prices worldwide. On Thursday, Trump said the U.S. is using minesweepers in the region, but there are no known U.S. minesweepers there. Hegseth dodged a question about Pentagon estimates that it could take 6 months to clear the strait. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The White House says President Trump is issuing a 90-day extension of the Jones Act waiver to ease oil disruptions. President Trump has announced a 3-week extension to pause the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. But as NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from Beirut, both sides have continued to acknowledge attacks despite the agreement.
Hezbollah says it fired rockets into northern Israel Thursday night. The Israeli military says all were intercepted. That's after an Israeli airstrike killed prominent Lebanese journalist Amal Khalil while she was reporting in the south, the 8th journalist killed by Israel in Lebanon in the past 2 months. The Israeli military responded to Hezbollah's attack by carrying out several more airstrikes in the south on what it says were military structures. All of this occurred as the Israeli and Lebanese ambassadors were in Washington to discuss the extension of the ceasefire. Iran-backed Hezbollah has been opposed to direct talks, while Iran insisted on a ceasefire in Lebanon to continue peace talks with the U.S. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Beirut.
Today, people in northern Oklahoma are assessing tornado damage. Multiple twisters touched down last night. The city of Enid was hit especially hard. It's about 100 miles north of Oklahoma City. There are no reports of deaths. The tech company Meta is laying off about 10% of its staff. NPR's John Ruich reports an internal memo says the company is reorganizing.
A Meta spokesperson confirmed the internal memo. In it, Meta's chief people officer Janelle Gale says the layoffs are part of a continued effort to run the company more efficiently. The cuts will also allow it to offset other investments the company's making. Gale says while it's unwelcome news that puts employees in an uneasy state, the company feels it's the best path forward given the circumstances. The layoffs will take place on May 20th. Meta also will not hire for 6,000 open roles that it had intended to fill. In January, Meta forecast record capital expenditures this year of up to $135 billion, almost double what it spent last year. John Ruich, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The British King and Queen head to the U.S. next week for a state visit, timed with the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution. President Trump says he thinks their visit can help heal transatlantic relations. The U.S. and United Kingdom have been at odds over wars in Ukraine and Iran and over NATO, as NPR's Lauren Freyer reports.
In a 5-minute phone call with the BBC, President Trump was asked whether King Charles and Queen Camilla's state visit can help heal transatlantic relations. "Absolutely, he's fantastic," the BBC quoted Trump as responding about the king. As for British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, whom Trump used to call a friend but has recently repeatedly been saying is, quote, no Winston Churchill, Trump said Starmer can recover if he tightens his immigration policy. The Trump administration has accused the UK and other European governments of being lax on immigration. operation in a way that ruins their culture. This, along with British opposition to the U.S. and Israeli war on Iran, has led to a rift in U.S.-British relations ahead of this royal visit next week. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Alexandria, Scotland.
Wildfires are burning in southern Georgia and northern Florida. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp will tour the damage and meet with first responders today. The governor said Black Hawk helicopters are being deployed to help combat the flames. Microsoft will offer voluntary buyouts to more than 8,000 U.S. employees next month, according to the Associated Press. That's about 7% of the software company's domestic workforce. I'm Kristen Wright, NPR News. From Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, it's Friday, and every Friday we get to hear from Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. Happy Friday, Dan.
I think I've heard about him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Happy Friday.
He's the guy with the Dan jokes.
Who you can see coming for miles around because I'm tall and bald.
You're in a good mood for Friday.
Well, you know, I'll kick it off nicely. Maybe you should have me on, though, on Mondays, because everyone's in such a bad mood.
We need that Although, energy.
Everyone gets upset with me and aggravated when I come in the office in a good mood on Monday. You know, people are like, it's a Monday. I'm like, it's a start of a new week to get to do interesting, fun things. And they're like, shut up. Yeah.
Always a ray of sunshine.
I try to be, so that's how I approach life.
Well,
so.
Let's talk about our rays of sunshine in the Sullivan County Legislature. Yesterday, the legislative meeting heard from the Human Rights Office. Now, remind folks that there's a new Human Rights Director there. And was this an annual report? What was this report?
Actually, he's been with us now almost a full year.
Yeah,
Can you believe it? I was thinking, no, that can't be possible. But yes, it's our first full-time executive director we've ever had for the Human Rights Commission. His name is Ramon Wilson. He is actually a very accomplished musician as well, been part of Grammy Award-winning bands and singers. He has a fascinating backstory, but for what he's doing with the Human Rights Commission, wow, it's been quite a thing to see him hit the ground running. And of course, he has been seeing how many different complaints and issues there are out there. Of course, not everything is founded, but enough has been founded that he has been very busy.
What are some of the things that he's seen or the office has seen in terms of the types of complaints or things that are being looked at?
Mostly, he gets complaints about housing issues. Mm-hmm. There are always landlord-tenant disputes going on, people who feel that they were discriminated against. He also hears things, though, about issues in school or issues with law enforcement. Again, not everything is founded, but these are things that he has tried to create inroads with the different agencies to talk more about and bring awareness to, and also to try to help folks who are looking for things that the Human Rights Office can't necessarily provide. Like, we can look into the housing issue, but they can't provide housing for you, but he can refer you to other folks. Of course, if it's something that requires an actual investigation, criminal or civil, but an actual legal investigation, the local Human Rights Office isn't empowered to do that. That gets punted up to the New York State Office of Human Rights.
So if someone does make a complaint about, for instance, a housing issue, there's only so much this office can do in terms of investigation.
Yeah, he tries to understand what's going on. I mean, he does investigate insofar as just like you or I would, to find out more information. It's not a legal investigation. It's just a Q&A. And if he can, Research. He talks to, for example, in housing issues, if it's a tenant, he'll try to talk to the landlord as well. He'll try to see if they maybe could go to mediation on something or if they can just work things out, which I think he's been successful in doing before, but it doesn't always work out that way. So he came to the legislature yesterday to talk about possibly creating official legal investigatory powers for the county office, which would have to be conferred upon it by the state.
And what prompted that request or that discussion of having this office get those investigatory
He just thinks power. There's enough out there that really does need to be investigated in a more official, legal way, where maybe the office actually has some teeth mm-hmm. to it, so that when they're approached, they can't just be brushed off, which I'm sure he's been brushed off before, where it's like, no, I'm legally empowered. I have official authority to investigate this and can compel people to speak and cooperate on investigations, and then make some sort of a determination that if something is founded, that it could be prosecuted.
What was the tenor of the discussions? Were legislators cannot talk this morning in favor of this idea, or what was the discussion?
There wasn't really anything that was decided in any way. Legislators were interested. But of course, they're also wary about it because it comes with probably a need for additional staffing in a time of it's very fiscally challenging right now. And also, what do those powers entail? And what would, for example, the county attorney's office have to be involved in as well with it? It's not just something necessarily that would be confined to the human rights office. So there's a lot of considerations to be taken into account. And I think legislators, none of them seem to be outright opposed to it. But for example, legislator Bernardo said, when it comes to school district issues, there are elected school board members. The county has no authority over a school district. The state education department does, and so do those elected school board members and the administration. So she is like, do we have any kind of authority? Could we have any kind of authority over that? So there's some doubt there on some legislators as well, but none of them said, let's not go forward with this. My understanding is our county attorney's office is now going to be talking with other counties and their attorney's offices and human rights offices that may do this as to how is this accomplished. And also, of course, talking to the New York State Office of Human Rights to see what they say about this.
Is there a feeling also that perhaps if it gets moved up to the state level, it just gets absorbed into a much larger caseload for them and may not get the attention it deserves, these complaints?
What Ramon said he only recently found out is that the state has a 2 to 3 year backlog
wow.
on this. And he says there are people who just can't wait. He says he has people in their 90s who have made these complaints. And he says, to be perfectly frank, brutally honest, they can't wait 2 or 3 years for the resolution of this complaint. And listen, anybody of any age, who would want to wait 2 or 3 years for a complaint to be resolved? This was the first legislators had heard of that as well. So that was a concern that may be brought to our state representatives to say, maybe the state office needs to be better staffed and have people getting to these quicker, because if you get a human rights complaint, you're turning around and telling people they have to wait 2 or 3 years to get it resolved.
Yeah,
that just doesn't seem reasonable. Right. So there are a number of different things to be explored here. There'll be more, I'm sure, discussion about it. This was the first time it was brought up.
In other news, some good news, some major progress on the issue of children who were born addicted in Sullivan County. There's some new data. Who is sharing this data?
Yeah, our Commissioner of Health and Human Services, John Little, had talked about this. I believe he's going to be talking to Kim.
We'll have more, yeah.
So you'll have more in-depth. So I'm just going to gloss over mm-hmm. it here, but I think it is worth mentioning that we just obtained data from the State Department of Health. Showing that while Sullivan County is still above the state average for the rate of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, we're down about 70% from the peak in 2020. That's a 70% decrease in the past 6 years. So it's now 16.9 live births out of every 1,000 live births versus what it used to be, which was 57.1 out of 1,000 live births were born addicted. John indicated there were a variety of reasons probably for this, because we're also seeing, thankfully, a similar decline overall in opioid overdoses and deaths in Sullivan County. You know, Narcan, of course, has played a role in helping with all of that. But the reduction in neonatal withdrawal seems to point to broader success in helping mothers prevent, reduce, or end their drug use. That, in other words, the work that our drug task force is doing so hard every day and doesn't get enough appreciation and credit for is working.
Yeah.
It's working. That's exciting news. I can't tell you how much this has impacted the morale of those people, because it's so hard. And, you know, you turn around and people are just talking down about it on social media. Oh, we're doing nothing. No, we're doing something, and it's having a measurable impact.
Kimberly Izar will be speaking with Commissioner Little, and we'll have more details on that report and progress and good news on Monday on Radio Chatskill. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government about what's going on in Monticello. Some other good news, the Certified Home Health Agency has improved its readings.
Yes, we call this internally CHA because Certified Home Health Agency actually goes to CHHA. This is part of our Health and Human Services Division and our public health team. Again, Commissioner Little had reported on this that we have had a long tradition of strong patient survey ratings, which is five-star ratings from Medicare.gov. That's where a lot of people go to see these ratings for patient satisfaction. But what has been a lot more challenging is achieving high-quality ratings, which are based on statistics, not on surveys, such as starting care in a timely fashion after hospital discharge and patient care outcomes. Now, we're a county that has a lot of healthcare outcomes that just aren't the greatest, even with a lot of work that we do. But for the first time in a lot of years, our CHA has achieved a three-star quality rating. Always been difficult to obtain because of our below-average health incomes, but it indicates that the CHA's hard work is bending the curve toward better health outcomes for everyone in Sullivan County. And that's exciting. And again, I bet that has really helped boost their morale as well, because these people get involved not to just, you know, take a paycheck from the taxpayers to feed their family kind of thing. Although obviously feeding your family is important. What they do is they want to help the community, to help people be healthier, live better lives. And it is so satisfying when you see the statistics, the data back that up, saying you are doing what you need to do.
The heap cooling benefit applications are now open. We are in a time where we can talk about hot weather instead of cold weather. I mean, cooling. Let's remind folks again about the heap cooling benefit.
Yeah, this is something that I enjoy talking about, especially since people associate heap with heat. I think because it sounds like right. It as well. But it actually stands for the Home Energy Assistance Program. Well, you're not just using energy during the winter. You are using energy during the summer. However, it's a little bit different what they offer with the cooling benefit. Instead of actually paying for your electricity costs or something else with the energy you're using, if you are eligible, and lots more people probably are than they realize, the state will pay to give you a free air conditioner, or if you don't have a place to install that, a fan. Most people, though, get the air conditioner, and not only do they get the air conditioner, it gets installed by a professional contractor that the state pays, no cost to the person getting it. My own mom has benefited from this. She has multiple sclerosis, so she has a medical condition where if she gets overheated, it could be actually lethal for her. So that makes her eligible. Of course, you know, she also hits some other eligibility guidelines as well, but she was so impressed. This really nice team came a few years ago and installed this wonderful, up-to-date, not some low-cost air conditioner. It was a really good air conditioner run by remote control as well. So because she's in a scooter, so she can't always reach where it is, she could do it with the remote control. It has literally been a lifesaver for her.
Now, last fall, winter, there were some issues with heating in terms of funding. Mm-hmm. Any issues with funding for the heap cooling program right now?
Only the usual one, which is because there's a limited amount of money and lots of people apply. If you wait, you're probably not going to get it, not because you're ineligible, but because there's no money left. There's always a limited supply, even in good years with it. So it's time to apply. The way to apply is to give a call to our heap office. They have wonderful, friendly, very informed people there. 845-807-0142. That's 807-0142. They can answer your questions and help you apply.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with more from Dan Hoost. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
This week on CatsCast, we're back in Pine Hill, where a town of just a few hundred residents has spent 25 years building something remarkable. A community center offering art, music, pottery, and lots more.
I feel like we have become a space for folks to really age in place, and I love that so much because I think I moved back and I hope to age in place here. So
Saturday at 11 a.m.,
right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, joined in the studio by Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, Dan Hoost, as we are every Friday. We were just talking in the break about the fiber initiative that's going on in Sullivan County with the county and Archtop Fiber. And it's been going on for a while, but I'm bringing it up because I've been noticing it more because it's happening in my area on the way to and from work. I can see the progress that they're making over there. And you see those like orange tubes that are kind of popping up there. That's the fiber they're laying. And fascinating and amazing also that, you know, in our rural area, we're getting this high tech.
That's the whole idea. And super fast internet, 8 to 10 gigabits per second. So I don't know exactly what that translates to other than it probably will be almost an instantaneous experience when you're online. And that's not only with the wired part. There's a wireless component that is coming into play too. All 12 of our emergency communications towers are going to be outfitted with equipment that can transmit and receive wireless internet signals. This is different from a cell signal. This is the same kind of signal that's going through the cable, except being transmitted over the air, so that we'll reach a lot more people than just where that cable is going. Because if you're not seeing it going in front of your house, it doesn't mean you may not actually have access to it.
Right. In my case, it's not going in front of my house. It's going on the road near my house, but I still could get access. And you can check the progress of that on the website, at the government website.
There's a ConnectSullivan.com. Well, it's up and you can see where it's going. And if it's not to you yet, when it might get there, we're supposed to, according to the grant, we got a $30 million grant, largest in our history. We're supposed to be done by December. We may have to extend that a little bit. We'll see how it goes because we're burying almost all the cable, 99% of the cable's being buried. And I want to mention that as well, as a lot of people look at it and say, hey, wait a minute, you're digging up my lawn, especially when I want to be planting things or keeping it looking good. We're sorry that that is necessary, but it will make the system far more reliable than if it's up on poles. And also, Archtop Fiber, our private partner, is absolutely 100% committed to restoring it back to the way that it was. What happens, though, a lot of times is the initial construction crew comes down, does their work, continues moving on down the road, and people think the cleanup crew is right behind them. It's not. Could take a few days. Could take a few weeks, but they're going to come back and restore it to the way that it was. So we just ask people to be patient with us about that.
Which, I mean, I've been tracking the progress just visually on my own because it's on the way, as I said, to work and to home. And I've seen where, you know, you see where some of the orange tubes are up, but it also looks like it may not have been dug up. It seems as if they are putting it back, and it's not in the middle of someone's yard. It's really kind of on the edge by the road.
It's in the right of way.
Yeah, the right of way. But again, it just sort of looks like it had been there.
Yeah, and that's the whole idea in the end is
at least
to
what I saw.
Yeah, it's to make it look like nothing was ever there to begin with it and to get it back to your lawn. But for right now, the installation, it's being buried. It's going to be a little bit messy. Yeah. So we ask people to be patient and we will be back. Well, Archtop will be back, not the county. But we're minding that as well because we want our residents to ultimately be happy with this service, or at least be happy that their lawn was restored, even if they don't use this service.
Have you know that those television commercials where the people are turning into their parents, the insurance company commercials? I feel like that's me when it comes to this. Like, fellas, you're going across the road over here. How'd you do that?
you should try that sometime. Maybe that insurance guy will suddenly appear and say it out. Now, what are you doing, Tim?
Walk me away.
What are you doing?
Walk me slowly away. Let's go to some other topics. The Sullivan County Airport Terminal is open for office space business. Folks can rent office space there.
Yeah, this is exciting. This just happened yesterday. The legislature approved the rental rates or lease rates. I'm not exactly sure what it's going to be for the offices that we have in the terminal. We have six smaller offices, 135 square feet apiece, three upstairs and three downstairs, and then a 155 square foot office downstairs that looks out right on the runway. And we want to fill these offices with businesses, preferably ones that are geared towards business aviation interests, so that if pilots or other aviation businesses walk into the building, they have access to things there. But we're also interested in talking to anybody who might be interested in renting these spaces. I believe it's going to be $800 a month for the smaller space and $1,000 a month for the larger space, which I think is pretty competitive. And it includes all the utilities with it there, because we already provide the electricity and the water and, you know, the wastewater treatment. But it's part of the plan, which I'm at the lead of with marketing, to really turn this into a revenue generator for the taxpayers of Sullivan County, so that they are not having to support the operations of the airport at all anymore. And if not, just beyond that, actually, maybe we're making some money off of the airport.
Speaking of the airport, the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance was honored for their 50th anniversary at the legislature yesterday. Speaking of the airport, because that's where they're holding the 50th anniversary gala.
Yes, and I don't know which hat to wear. That yesterday was an odd moment for me, because I'm also the board president of the DVAA.
Full disclosure.
Yes, so I typically am the one taking the pictures, but they made me get into the picture with the 50th anniversary certificate the legislature presented. And we're very excited, as both a county official and as the DVAA board president, that we get to show off the airport in this way. May 16th is going to be the 50th anniversary gala at the airport, along with a big tent next to it, because the terminal itself can't fit all 200 people. But it is going to be extremely memorable, and I think a good way of showing to people the possibilities of this new terminal aren't just limited to what you would think with aviation. It's also going to be available for rental for events like this, or even smaller things. We already have people interested in holding birthday parties, because it's a gorgeous space and just has a wonderful view of the airport. Really shows off the landscape very nicely. But yes, congratulations to the DVAA. It's also a little weird that I am exactly the same age as DVAA. I'm 50 as well.
We'll celebrate you as well. Mm-hmm. Let's remind folks a couple of meetings and application deadlines. The Summer Youth Employment Program applications due in just a few days, April 30th.
Yep, April 30th. You can find that application online under our Center for Workforce Development. It's actually a Summer Youth Employment Program on our website, sullivanny.gov. Fill that out if you'd like your kid, a teenager, right up. I think actually we go up to age 20. If you're looking for them to have a summer job, maybe working with other kids their age as well, getting paid for it by the county and doing some good work. And it could be all sorts of things, from working in radio, actually, some of the kids have done before, to working in local gardens or office work as well. There's a lot of opportunity there, but you need to sign up before April 30th.
The next community meeting of the Sullivan County Drug Task Force is coming up May 15th.
Yep. And based on what we've been talking about, I think this is an interesting one for people to go to, because they are going to be talking about the progress that they have been making. It's not all about the challenges we face and the deaths and overdoses that are going on. Obviously, that'll be part of it. But the whole open community meeting idea, it's designed to create a welcoming space for dialogue, feedback, and collaboration, which means you're not going to just show up and watch what's going on. They're going to want you to participate with it. And that's what they say in their agenda, actually, is we want to hear directly from you what is working, what is still needed, what's missing as we continue to work on prevention, treatment, recovery, and support in the county. So if this is something you care about, if this is something you've been personally affected by, this is a great thing to come to. May 15th, it's a Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. in the Government Center's hearing room on the second floor in Monticello. You're going to hear from all the people who are directly engaged, and you will be able to directly engage with them. Absolutely not to be missed.
Right. The staff at the Government Center in government has conducted Litterpluck at the Government Center in the Social Services campus. Now, Litterpluck is the ongoing county effort for picking up litter. The Upper Delaware Council's litter sweep is happening this month. Yep. So everyone participating and contributing.
Yeah. And we wanted to set a good example for what we're encouraging everybody else to do. So our staff at both the Monticello and Liberty campuses went out on the coldest day of this week and actually picked up litter They did it not just on our property, but along the roadsides surrounding our properties as well. So sometimes they were across the street, for example, from the government center, and they were just picking things up. They had these cool grabbers that they were using and picked up quite a bit of trash. I think we had about 17, 18 staff between the two campuses do it. We have some photos and video about it on our social media page, but really grateful that these people decided to do this and withstood the chilly, chilly temperatures to do it.
So. And shout out to volunteers of all stripes. Happy National Volunteers Week.
Yes, that's what this week is. I'm getting in on the very end of it here, but I am, of course, a proud volunteer, actually, not just with the DVAA, but through the Sullivan Volunteers Program. And I actually just recently signed up for that and just recently got my first check from the county. They reimburse you for the mileage from your home to your volunteer service location. So from where I live to travel to Narrowsburg for DVAA, it's about 10 miles one way, and they pay for that as long as I'm registered with them. And they are very much wanting to have more volunteers get involved with this program, because they're, what the county is trying to do is incentivize volunteering in the county. It's tough to get volunteers, but if you sign up with it, as long as you're an actual volunteer, not a paid member of, for you with JFF, but we can actually not only reimburse you for your mileage at the IRS rate of 77.5 cents per mile, but also cover you with some liability insurance.
Where can folks get the information?
It is actually on our website, sullivanny.gov. Just look up volunteers or Sullivan Volunteers.
And happy National Volunteers Week to our volunteers, all volunteers out there. You're doing great work. Thank
you.
Can't
do without them. Nope. Really can't.
And thank you, Dan Hoos, Sullivan County Government.
A pleasure as always.
See you next week. Coming up, after months in detention, Afghan refugee and Bard College student Ali Fakhrizadeh is free, and his case has become a powerful symbol in the region's immigration debate. We'll have more on the community effort that helped secure his release. Stay with us. This is Radio Chatskill.
The satirical newspaper The Onion is taking over InfoWars, the media empire created by right-wing blowhard Alex Jones, and replacing the hate with comedy. Why?
I think people need to hear other people like me remind the world that this is insane. Otherwise, people feel like they're going crazy and that they're alone.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC. Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Ali Fakhrizadeh, an Afghan refugee and Bard College student who was detained by federal immigration officers after an interview as part of his asylum case in October, has been released. That was announced by Bard College President Leon Botstein in a public announcement. His release follows a sustained community campaign to secure his freedom, which drew support from Bard College, the Episcopal Diocese of New York, and elected officials like U.S. Representative Pat Ryan. His case had become one of the most high-profile immigration cases in upstate New York. Jason Dole spoke with the Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Philip Pantuso for more details.
So Ali Fakhrizadeh has lived the past several years with his family in New Paltz in Ulster County. I think all other eight of his family members have gone through the asylum process here in the United States. He is still in that process, but he has been living here. He's a guard at the Kingston Hospital. He's attending classes at Bard's post-baccalaureate program. And as part of his asylum case, he went down to what's called a credible fear interview on Long Island in October. And at that hearing, he was detained by ICE agents, despite the fact that the person who interviewed him said that he did have a credible case for asylum and had scheduled a hearing for him with an immigration judge. His family, when they were in Afghanistan, helped U.S. non-governmental organizations obtain licenses to do work in Afghanistan. And then they faced threats from the Taliban, which had been well-documented, and forced them to flee. So, yeah, this case garnered a lot of attention. It got national coverage. I think it was in the New York Times. It was definitely on PBS NewsHour. And in part because of the nature of the arrest, a lot of people saw it as symbolic of the Trump administration's crackdown, not just on immigration broadly, but on legal pathways to citizenship. This is a guy who, again, there's no criminal record, no issues with him. He was going through the asylum process. He and his family helped U.S. companies in Afghanistan on the ground during the war over there. And he had just been deemed to have a credible asylum case. So there was a lot of organizing around this from Bard, from elected officials like Pat Ryan, from the church group in New Paltz that he is involved in, and by just other community members. And we got the news yesterday, I believe it was, that he had been released by ICE. This came out actually in a statement from Bard College president Leon Botstein, who I've talked about on the show in a very different context a few times in recent weeks. And in that statement, he said that Ali was actually released several weeks ago, but out of caution and respect for his privacy, we have waited to share the news with the entire Bard community until he was ready to do so. But we were told he is now back with his family in Ulster County and plans to resume work and taking classes soon.
Is there any other response from the community or any of the people that were rallying for him?
Yeah, the lawyer at Human Rights First, the refugee advocacy group who was representing him, said that we were greatly relieved at Ali's release and are deeply grateful to everyone, his fellow students, teachers, and administrators at Bard, his Hudson Valley community, religious leaders, and elected representatives, both state and federal, and Republican and Democratic, who advocated for him to be allowed to return to his family and resume his life. And, you know, a host of elected officials have said similar things, from Michelle Hinchey to Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger to Pat Ryan, who have been advocating for him at the federal level as well. And it's worth noting, just kind of picking up something there from the attorney statement, this was kind of a bipartisan issue, at least locally. Republican officials were also saying that, you know, this seemed to violate due process and is essentially not the type of immigration crackdown that they were in support of.
What is his status now? I mean, he's been released from ICE. Does that mean his asylum appeal request is still going to keep going through that process? Do we know what the next steps are for him?
Yeah, we're trying to find out that as well, and we're not totally sure. His attorneys and his family are not really talking too much about that on the record, at least right now, due to the sensitivity of the situation. Obviously, I think they're still trying to recover from what had been a pretty traumatic event, particularly for him. We did see, according to court filings, that an appeal from the government to continue to hold him was dismissed. But it's quite hard to track immigration cases in federal databases, just because there aren't there's much more privacy protections around those, and so you can't just like look up all the latest filings and read them. You basically have to have the court or one of the parties turn it over to you, and yeah, that's not really happening in this case.
And I think it speaks not just to the sensitivity of the actual case, but also the further level of confusion surrounding anybody dealing with immigration issues right now in America. So even at this stage of the story, this story is also kind of emblematic of the bigger stories and implications of what's happening with ICE right now, because at every level, there's some degree of confusion.
Yeah. I think it's safe to assume that he will at least continue trying to pursue his asylum case. You know, there had been like a pending deportation order that was filed not long after he was arrested. It's unclear if that is still relevant. It's not totally clear under what conditions or terms he was released. You know, if and when we find out more, we will, of course, report on that.
We've been talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley. And Philip, once again, thank you so much.
You got it. Take care.
There's more at timesunion.com. Coming up, how one Earth Day celebration this weekend aims to turn small actions into lasting environmental impact. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we have a poignant and soulful look at Caribbean food with Chef Ralston Williams. And we've got the internet's favorite meatball, Dan Pelosi, taking your cooking questions with me. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. The Pocono Environmental Education Center, a nonprofit focused on environmental education and sustainable living, is hosting its annual Earth Day Festival in Dingmans Ferry, Pennsylvania tomorrow. The event will feature hands-on activities, artisan exhibits, live music, food, and even a chance for kids to connect with nature through programs led by the National Park Service. Joining us now is Amanda Subjan, Chief Executive Officer of the Pocono Environmental Education Center. Amanda, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tim. So great to be on the show.
Well, for folks who may not be familiar with the Pocono Environmental Education Center, how does this Earth Day Festival fit into your work?
Well, PEAK loves to celebrate Earth Day. One of our mottos here is Earth Day every day. Since 1972, PEAK has been a part of the Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area, offering environmental education programs in a residential overnight setting. So we do like to teach people year-round about Earth Day, and this is just one chance for us to celebrate that across our campus for our local community.
And Earth Day events have been happening ever since Earth Day earlier this week, and a lot of them happening this weekend. What makes the PEAK Festival in Dingmans Ferry unique?
Well, this year we're going to focus very heavily on sustainability. All of our partners, conservation partners, and others from the area are bringing something that's sustainability-minded. So there will be giveaways, there will be activities, and all of this will focus on how you, as a normal person in your everyday life, can bring sustainability into your home and into your workplace.
There's also a strong hands-on component. Why is that kind of interactive learning so important, especially for kids?
That's the best thing that PEAK does. We immerse people in nature and we connect people to an appreciation for nature. And the easiest way to do that is through hands-on experience. So being able to see in person all of the live critters that will be at the live animal presentation and learn about them and their habitats, coming into our EcoZone discovery room and being able to crawl into a bat cave or walk into a beaver lodge and understand firsthand by seeing and feeling what it's like to be one of those animals is the way that we connect people to nature. We're also going to provide a lot of fun things like a summer camp experience. If you've never tie-dyed something, this is a great opportunity to do that yourself. And then some hands-on crafts and activities that teach people about nature.
I have never tie-dyed and I have never been in a bat cave. So that sounds fun. What are some of the live critters you've got there?
We have a resident black rat snake whose name is Garrett, and she is the favorite amongst most of our school-age children that come to visit PEAK. Garrett also goes on field trips to go to different schools, and she will be here in her habitat in the eco zone. We also have some turtles, so we teach about native and non-native species, and then there will be a live animal presentation, and I am not sure what animals will be a part of that because that is a guest presenter.
A surprise live animal presentations.
That's right.
Also, you're doing a festival. The festival is drawing families, sorry, of all ages. You know, what role does an event like this play in building that environmental awareness at the community level for you?
I think it starts with just a familiarity with being outdoors and developing a love for nature, and that is different for every person. It could be different across a whole family, but PEAK does like to showcase all of the different opportunities that we offer here at our facility. If it was canoeing or birding or taking a hike on a trail or just sitting outside in the quiet of nature, it really depends on what clicks for you. So this is an opportunity to see everything in action and be able to talk to all of our education staff and enjoy what PEAK has to offer while also having fun as a group.
And does it also give you a chance to educate folks about some of the environmental issues facing the region right now and how folks can make a difference?
Absolutely. The easiest way to make a difference is to feel connected to something. So if you can learn about the animals and their habitat and our waterways, our watershed, and how important it is to protect that waterway, that leads you down the road to further take action. And that's what PEAK really strives to do, is form that connection so that you can be a better steward of our planet.
You know, and we were talking about the fun part of it and the animals and all the demonstrations. But for families who attend, how can they keep that environmental awareness going beyond the Earth Day Festival?
Well, the simplest way is to come and enjoy the wonderful giveaways that, thanks to our generous sponsors, including AM Skyer Insurance and Custom Laminating and LamTech Corporation, we're going to have some really special sustainability giveaways for those folks who brave the rain this weekend and make their way out. But then you'll be able to also connect with our conservation partners and learn from folks like SEEDS and the Pike County Conservation District and our National Park Service about how you can be a better steward. The Park Service specifically is offering 9 junior ranger badges. Some of those include information about wildland firefighting or river safety or a specific badge just for the Upper Delaware Scenic River National Park Service unit. So you can actually learn and then connect to that place and have a special badge to go home with to show that you learned how to be the steward.
And let's go over the key details of the Earth Day Festival. What should people know before they arrive? And is there anything that folks should bring or be prepared for, especially since you mentioned there might be some rain?
It looks like Saturday is our rainy day this weekend. We seem to have been getting one since the snow stopped. So this is an opportunity for families with kids who are saying, oh my goodness, what will we do this weekend? Indoor and outdoor activities at peak. So we will have space for you to stay nice and dry. We'll have space for you to dodge the raindrops. Come prepared for the weather. And then also it's $5 per car to get in and park. But then after that, it's really just all the exhibits are free. You can visit the vendors. So if you wanted to bring cash for potential purchases, there's also food for purchase in our dining hall, which is passive solar and sustainability themed. You can also bring an umbrella, but rest assured there is a covered wagon ride across campus.
That sounds great. Just before we go, what does it personally mean to you to lead an organization like PEAK, not just on Earth Day, but as you say, Earth Day every day?
It's pretty important and special to me. I grew up coming to PEAK. I started here in high school as my first job and went out into the world and came back here because really what PEAK means to me is an opportunity to continue the legacy of being connected to our Earth. And if we can see these happy faces come and a spark is lit and they feel connected to the planet, then we're doing a great job.
That's Amanda Subgen, Chief Executive Officer of the Pocono Environmental Education Center, or PEAC, P-E-E-C. Their Earth Day celebration is tomorrow from 11 to 4. You can find out more about that and all of the events and opportunities at PEAC at peec.org. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. Have a great weekend.
Coming up after a break, a community celebration of poetry. This is Radio Chatskill.
When most people think of Dubai, they envision wealth. But with the war with Iran spilling across borders, the country's tourism has slowed. Migrant workers feel the difference.
Are you getting the same salary now as you did like 2 months ago?
No, we have different.
Because of this issue for missiles.
I'm Scott Detrow. The ripple effects of a regional war on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Chatskill, and National Poetry Month is celebrated every April. It has been since 1996 by the Academy of American Poets. It's the world's largest literary celebration, highlighting poetry's vital role in culture. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Kevin Scott Graham, Sullivan County Poet Laureate, about a community celebration of poetry tomorrow. And community members are welcome to read their own poetry, a favorite poem, or just come and listen.
Good morning. This is Valerie Manzi for Radio Chatskill. And a nice celebration is coming up this weekend. It's a community celebration of poetry. And it's going to be hosted by Sullivan County's current poet laureate, and that is Kevin Scott Graham. And he's here to talk about that, to talk about National Poetry Month, as well as his writing and his experience as a poet. So welcome, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I see here that it's the 30th anniversary of National Poetry Month. So it's certainly something to celebrate.
Always something to celebrate, but yes, even more so this year, I guess.
Yeah, I remember when it first started, way back in 1996. What are you planning for Saturday?
Well, this Saturday, Monticello Library, Ethelbert B. Crawford Public Library, to be exact, at 10:30 a.m., there'll be a lot of reading, poetry. I'm going to be doing something that I did several months ago, maybe almost a year back, at the Calicoon Library for their First Fridays event, where I improvised music and then read my poetry along to the music I improvised. The idea behind it is that it's kind of like I'm making like an improvised film score, essentially, for the poetry that I'm reading. So that's what I'll be doing. In addition to that, there'll be other people reading some of their poetry and others of their favorite poets. I'm going to read a bunch of my poetry, obviously, and I might read a couple of poems from a couple of my favorite poets as well.
And who are they?
And we'll invite the public also to read. I was thinking about maybe reading something from Larry Levis. He's one of my favorite poets. And I might read a couple of short ones from Victoria Chang, from one of my favorite books called The Trees Witness Everything.
And you mentioned that members of the public will also be sharing their poetry?
Of course. Of course. I mean, that's something that I always work into any event that I'm part of. I love hearing people's work. I love hearing different perspectives. And I love giving people a platform to show off their work. So that's definitely a possibility for anybody that wants to, or you could just come and listen. It's definitely not mandatory, but if you feel as though you start to gain the courage along the way, you know, we'll have a space for you to come up and read.
What drew you to poetry?
Well, to be honest, I think early on when I was a kid struggling with attention deficit disorder and reading longer form things, it was really just how short the things were, how short the pieces were. But I could actually read an entire piece and kind of get an entire story. And I'm also a very imaginative person, a very creative person. And so I love doing a lot of imagining with very few variables, very few words. Part of the reason why I like abstract art and making abstract art as well. I think there's a lot of room for interpretation and a lot of room for imaginative filling in of the gaps. So that's initially what drew me to it. Yeah, as I got older and was writing more, I find it to be fascinating how you can say so much with so few words. Of course, there's all different types of poetry, but I really have a soft spot for shorter form poetry. Not necessarily haiku, though. That's great. Just trying to make something as vivid and expressive as possible with the fewest amount of words.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I'm going to refer to a previous poet laureate, Eric Balin, and he posted a couple of haikus recently, called Mid-March Haiku, and then the other day for Scythia Haiku. And, of course, they were very short, but so poignant, and in those few words, the beauty and essence that gets communicated. It's astounding that so few words can do that. I've always been fond of haiku for that reason.
Yeah, me too. And that's The Trees Witness Everything, Victoria Chang book, is what I might read a few from in there. It's experimenting with a variety of different rhythmic patterns similar to the haiku and the haiku, just different syllabic patterns, but they're all very short like that. And I think that's an interesting framework to work within. And I think a lot of people enjoy working within a framework. It's not necessarily for me, just the framework itself. I love freedom in general, but also minimalism. So I guess that is somewhat of a framework anyway. But Eric is an incredible poet. I've done some collaborations with him over the last couple of years, and he's been a mentor for me in this poet laureate process. And I think we're very much aligned on that. You know, efficiency of language and the beauty and leaving room and space for others to interpret and interact with the piece essentially is what you're doing when it's like that. You're interacting with this you're participating in the words by conjuring your own imagery. It's really it's a beautiful process. So again, this also ties into what drew me or what continues to draw me to poetry is all of this stuff.
Do you ever write in long form?
Occasionally. When I write in the longer form stuff that I write tends to be a little bit more dry, philosophical, psychological things, just ponderances, life, things like that. I tend to go long form on that type of stuff, but not as much on the artistic side.
And you mentioned also that you were an artist.
Yes.
What is your media?
My main medium, my main voice is music and guitar specifically. But I play a variety of other instruments, but guitar is the one that I have the largest vocabulary and expressive prowess at. And then I do visual art as well, pen and ink drawings and watercolor. I had a show at the Narrowsburg Union back in like 2019. I was part of a group show, actually with one of your DJs, Patricio Rubio, had a bunch of photographs in that show as well. So I kind of get myself into a lot of different things, and poetry is something I've always written, but I'd say more recently in my life, in the last number of years, has it become something that I've discovered this sort of improvisational spark that I approach all of my art with. But it always was kind of a little bit more elusive for me with words because there seem to be more guidelines, you know, because there's vocabulary, there's meanings to words.
Yes.
But when I started to take more freedom with it and open up my, or sort of close down my consciousness, essentially, just shut it off a little bit and let words flow in a natural way, I found a lot of very interesting things come out that maybe on the surface didn't appear to make as much sense, but had a lot of meaning to me in my heart, essentially. And I really started becoming very productive. And that's actually how I ended up applying to be the poet laureate initially, was because a friend of mine that I was assembling a book at the time. And then he said, oh, you know, they're looking for a new poet laureate, you should apply. And so I did eventually.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history. And then my term is almost up, too.
I know that.
We'll be having a new poet laureate, yeah.
Yeah, well, we look forward to that, too. And well, I also wanted to mention when I was reviewing the history of National Poetry Month, I came across Poem in Your Pocket. This idea of sharing poetry with other people. You find a piece of poetry you like and go out in the world and share it with a couple of people. And I liked that idea.
Oh, yeah, I love that idea. I love sharing poetry with people. I love hearing people's poetry. I love encouraging people to find their voice and to embrace it and share with courage. And because I think it just benefits everybody involved always. It's just a beautiful thing.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
You know, maybe just to restate that it's 10:30 to noon at the Ethelbert B. Crawford Library in Monticello. And I think it's going to be a really wonderful experience. If you just want to come listen to poetry and some music that I'll be playing, I have no idea what I'm going to be playing. Like I said, it's improvised. But it should be something beautiful and heartfelt. And if you want to read your own poetry, please show up also and do that. I look forward to seeing people.
Well, have a really good day.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi and speaking to the Sullivan County Poet Laureate, Kevin Scott Graham. That will do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, our free weekly newsletter comes out every Friday. It hit inboxes this morning. Did it hit yours? If not, sign up at wjffradio.org and you'll get it every Friday for free in your inbox. Stay up on all the latest local news, culture, and events in the area with our free weekly newsletter. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org and from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Emma Straub, novelist and children's book author. Her new book, American Fantasy, takes place on a cruise ship with a 1990s boy band. She'll also talk about running one of New York's most beloved independent bookstores. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill Local News, Culture, and NPR. Today's weather: clouds should yield to some sun this afternoon and a high of 61. Tonight, some periods of rain and a low of 38. That rain will continue all day tomorrow, and it'll be a lot colder. Tomorrow's high only 40, a low of 35 tomorrow night, but back up to 57 for Sunday with partly sunny skies in the afternoon, mostly sunny on Monday, and 64.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we just ask the question.
Is that statement true?
Get to the point with NPR every weekday morning.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.